Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present, of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. until 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Tuesday Breakfast on today, the 7th of April 2026. And thank you to the Radioactive Show, 3CR's national program on nuclear peace and energy issues. My name is Fung, and in the studio today we've got Fiza and Julia. Good morning.
Good morning, Fung.
Good morning.
Good morning, Julia.
Hey.
How has everyone's weekend been?
Yes, pretty good. We had some Easter celebrations, that kind of thing, family function. yes, all the...
As you do.
Yeah, the relatives asking the big questions.
Big life
what
questions.
What are you doing?
Yeah.
Are you dating?
And just casually giving you a crisis in the middle of a long weekend. Yeah, lovely.
Yes, it's funny.
Easter eggs? Do we eat Easter eggs in this studio?
I was still celebrating Eid on Sunday, sorry to throw a spanner in there, but Emily, we celebrate Eid for like the whole month of Shawwal, because we fast for a month and we're like, we're going to be celebrating for a month.
Yeah.
So I have some of my Malay friends over here. So I was having Eid celebrations on Sunday.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was lovely.
I feel like, there's so much crossover.
Oh, absolutely. Our significant milestones are starting to,
which is great. It's just like so much celebration.
Yeah.
During a time when
I think it's just an excuse to come together and, and it was lovely because my friend who hosted, he's like, I've known him since uni and like I'm aging myself here, but it was over 20 years ago.
Wow,
this is someone who's known me for a very, very long time. And I think when you see someone like that, like it's very grounding. It kind of like reminds me like, oh, this person has known me since I was 18 and that's huge, right? Like that's like a nice return to yourself. And I think it's the same with family, right? Like you surround yourself day to day with so many strangers and, noise.
Yeah.
And then you be with family and you're like, oh, yeah, these people know me, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So. Or if you're spending, like, a lot of time on social media and then things can feel really warped.
Yeah, 100%, you just have to, right.
Spend time with people who know you.
Yeah.
Although, I don't know. Back when I was 18, I don't know if... I need those memories.
We didn't revisit anything. Some things are best left buried. Yeah.
Yes, all the faces.
Okay, so let's have a chat about what's coming up on today's show. At 7:15, we'll be replaying a segment from an Asia Pacific Currents program from late March. During which Giselle Hanna spoke to Shivani Kaur, who is a New Delhi-based political and labour movement activist. So this was on the 21st of March. And in their conversation, they speak about the introduction of the labour codes introduced in India in November last year, as well as the history of labour laws and the consolidation of these new codes following a resurgence in mass strike action in the country since February. At 7:30, we'll be replaying an interview that I had with Mish Pony, who is the CEO of Scarlet Alliance. We spoke last week for Women on the Line regarding the new online codes here requiring users to verify their age in order to access pornography. This is sort of a continuation of a conversation that we had with Lucinda Thorpe on Tuesday Breakfast a few weeks ago about what these codes will mean for people's privacy. But with Mish, we talk about how this will impact sex workers in particular.
And at 7:45, we will hear a replay from Accent of Women. This is featuring Tamil refugee and member of Refugee Women's Action for Visa Equality, Rathi Bathload. And she was speaking at the Unite to Fight Racism Forum that was held in February this year. And she shares about the struggles that she faced fighting for visa equality for refugees and the wins as well. So that's actually quite nice to hear.
And then at 8 a.m., we will have Camille Perry, who is a queer artist and photographer, whose work explores unique film processes and ecological ethics. And Camille will be discussing their work with us today in the studio.
And at 8:15, we'll be joined by Noor and Gabby from Unassigned Gallery to talk about their new life drawing sessions within the space, as well as upcoming events held at the gallery. So that's all that's coming up on today's show. We'll be back with the news headlines in just a moment.
Some folks know about it, some don't.
These are the news headlines for Tuesday, 7th of April, 2026. Rumbalara Aboriginal Cooperative, a major Aboriginal service provider in the Shepparton region, says free public transport while patrol cars soar is not much help if the bus only comes a couple of times a day. Greater Shepparton has the third highest Indigenous population of any LGA in Victoria. The bus to Rumbalara's main facility comes about once an hour on a weekday and requires a 20-minute walk from the closest stop if coming from Shepparton's major interchange. A train trip on the same line will get you a little closer, but arrives just 3 to 4 times between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m., and again, only leaving from Shepparton. We recognise the positive intent behind free public transport during the fuel crisis. However, the impact for regional communities like ours is minimal, said Rumbalara Chief Executive Felicia Dean. The Victorian Council of Social Service, the state's social and community sector, shared a similar sentiment. VCOS Chief Executive Juanita Pope shared that a month of free public transport would be more impactful if the government also focused on providing extra public transport for people for whom these forms of transport are essential.
Also in the news, late last week, the Quebec government in Canada adopted legislation that expands on secularism laws in the province. Bill 9, titled An Act Respecting the Reinforcement of Laïcité in Quebec, puts limits on praying in public and extends a ban on wearing religious symbols to daycare workers. The law will also ban subsidised daycare workers from wearing religious symbols, with the clause exempting those already in their position, prohibit public institutions such as hospitals from only offering food based on a religious tradition, such as halal or kosher meals, phase out public subsidies for religious private schools that select students or staff based on religious affiliation, and ban prayer spaces in public institutions, including universities, with some exceptions, as well as group prayers in public spaces such as parks without municipal authorization. It's the latest in a series of secularism laws passed in Quebec. Last October, the government also adopted a law banning religious symbols worn by any school employee who interacts with a student. In France, where la laïcité, or secularism, has been enshrined in law since 1905, conservative members of the French Senate have been accused of weaponizing the term. After publishing a report on combating so-called Islamism in late November, proposing a suite of measures that will curtail the rights of Muslims in the country.
In other news, members of the Stolen Generations and their families will be honoured at the 4th Ngarajaranam healing ceremony next month. In 2023, the first healing ceremony brought thousands to Victoria Park and continues to bring Nam's community together. The Indigenous Sports Network presents the event set for April 19 in partnership with Grandmothers Against Removal Victoria. Victoria Park in Abbotsford will be playing host this year. Grandmothers Against Removal Victoria, or GMAR, draws on the wisdom, strength and compassion of Aboriginal grandmas and aunties to support children and their families at risk of separation, providing family service and support. The Indigenous Sports Network, led by former Essendon champion Nathan Levette Murray, said the Ngarajarahon healing ceremony is more than an event. It is a space for truth-telling, cultural strength, and collective healing. It invites all to stand in solidarity with Stolen Generations families and to work together towards a stronger future grounded in respect and understanding.
Finally, in the headlines, last week, pay increases were announced for workers under the Health Professionals and Support Services Award following a Fair Work Commission under gender undervaluation decision. The union representing these workers, the Health Services Union, welcomed the increase, which affects a predominantly female workforce. Dental assistants, pathology collectors are among the workers impacted by the increase, with increases of up to 10% for both groups, phased over two stages. Health professionals were also awarded pay increases of up to 32%, which will come into effect later this year. HSU National Secretary Lloyd Williams remarked, "This is a major win for many HSU members who have been doing essential skilled work for years while being paid less than they deserve, mainly because they are jobs done overwhelmingly by women." Williams continued, "Today is an important milestone, but it is just the beginning. We will keep fighting to ensure every worker under this award is properly valued and paid fairly." These have been the news headlines for Tuesday, the 7th of April, 2026. You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalization intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
Staff liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo! Woo!
The state Labor government has begun works on demolishing Melbourne's 44 public housing towers to be replaced with private housing. Already, hundreds of residents have been displaced, often into unsuitable homes under duress.
The towers on Racecourse Road, Flemington, have become Homes Victoria work sites, while the families still living in the buildings are being treated appallingly.
Join Save Public Housing supporters in solidarity with residents.
Weekdays 7:30 till 9 a.m. as we engage with passing traffic to make some noise and show Jacinta Allen
that the demolition of public housing is unacceptable. Signs and banners provided or bring your own.
There's power in numbers, so see you at 120 Racecourse Road, Flemington, 7:30 till 9 a.m.
Save Public Housing is a 3CR supporter.
Keffiyehs are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people.
From the traditional black and white kaffiyeh to an array of modern designs. Explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. We're your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to kufiyas.org.au. That's kufiyas.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM, 3CR Digital and online at 3cr.org.au. Giselle Hanna from Asia Pacific Currents spoke to Shivani Kaur, New Delhi-based political and labour movement activist, on Saturday, the 21st of March. They spoke about the introduction of the labour codes introduced in India in November last year. Also in the conversation, they discussed the history of labour laws and the consolidation of these new labour codes following a resurgence in mass strike action in the country since February and what it means for workers.
I'm Shivani. I'm a political activist based in New Delhi, India. I'm part of a workers' organisation called Bigul Mazdoor Dasta. And I'm involved with various trade unions in and around Delhi.
So to begin with, can you please explain what the labour codes are?
Yes. So, you know, the labour codes and the talk surrounding introduction of labour code has been there for a long time. And I won't say just in 2014 when Modi government came to power. It's not just since then that they've been hell-bent upon, quote-unquote, reforming the erstwhile labor laws, but since 1999, when the earlier BJP government was in power, the Vajpayee government, Atal Bihari Vajpayee-led BJP government, which was a coalition government, even since 1999, there were a lot of discussions around changing the existing labor laws framework in India. So, for example, in 1999 itself, there was a second National Labour Commission, which was constituted by then Vajpayee government. And it came up with a report in 2002. And it was a very long 1700-page report, which actually talked about dismantling all kind of protection that the working class in India used to get with the erstwhile labour laws framework. Now, it's nobody's case that the earlier laws were pro-labor. Nobody's saying that. And when we are opposing the implementation of labor codes also, we are pointing to the fact that obviously they were insufficient and they were actually applicable only to a very small part of the working class in India, which was organized working class, the employees, which are employed in the formal sector of economy. So most of the informal sector and most of the organized workers informal sector as well, they did not automatically fall within the purview of the erstwhile labor laws themselves. But the fact is that even when these laws were there, there was a fair bit of chance then that when workers organized under the banners of their unions, when they collectively bargained and struggled, there was a chance that they could have got something implemented in their favor. And this has happened. For example, I, being a labor activist, and I have worked with so many trade unions in India, especially around Delhi. So, for example, there was a strike by unorganized sector workers in the steel industry in Delhi itself, which were unorganized informal workers. But when they struggled, when they collectively came together and launched an agitation to get these laws implemented in their favor, to a large extent, they were able to do that. But now with dismantling of this earlier framework, what Modi government has done in the name of reform, in the name of rationalization, in the name of simplification of old labor laws framework, it is actually now bending backwards to help the capitalist class in ease of doing business. So what does this ease of doing business actually mean? It means that all those provisions that were available in whatever measure, in whatever degree, and one can contest that too. But yes, whatever protections and whatever social security benefits, whatever legal guidelines there were there earlier, they have been dismantled. So now, you know, what was, you could say, a de facto reality for the majority of the working class in India has become a de jure reality now. Because now the contract system has been legalized. Now the right to strike, right to collective bargaining, this right that is actually enshrined in the constitution of this country, it has been criminalized. Now, under the guise of national floor level wages, capitalists are free to not pay minimum wages.
I want to ask about the number of strikes that have happened since the labour codes were announced. There's been quite a few since November, since the law's introduction, and a recent national strike in February. Can you tell us a little bit about which groups are striking, what their demands are, and tell us a little bit about workers' mobilisations in opposition to the laws and also the cost of living crisis?
Yeah. So, Giselle, what I want to point out is that now, yes, there was a one-day strike call, which was given by the central trade unions in India, which are backed by most of the social democratic parties. And there are some independent central trade unions as well. Now this one-day call was there, and these one-day national strike calls have been given since 1991 itself. So since 1994 itself, there have been 30 one-day or two-day national strike calls. There is a limitation to these one-day strike calls. The first thing is that now we have witnessed these strike actions taking place, but we have seen that the neoliberal assault by the bourgeois states, and I'm not just talking about the fascist Modi government. Before fascist Modi government was in place, there were other governments as well. And the onslaught of these neoliberal regimes on workers' rights has been there, and it's for everyone to see. Now, having said that, we have this experience behind us where we have seen that these one-day calls don't work anymore. Now, the governments also know that, this one-day action is going to happen, and this will be compensated by making workers work overtime in the coming days. So the one-day thing doesn't work at all. And the reality of the one-day strike is that even on these one days, it's too nominal. It's too, you can say, ritualistic. It's not there. It might sound very pessimistic, or people might point out the fact that even now when the, Modi government is attacking, and it is the biggest attack on the rights of the working class since independence, we accept that fact. But the kind of resistance and the kind of action, the kind of militancy that this kind of attack demanded is totally lacking. And our organization was at the forefront of running these campaigns because we found out that a large section of the working class does not even know what is there in the labor code. So the workers need to be educated. There is a general sense of apathy among the unorganized sector workers. So we need to approach them and tell them and educate them and inform them about how dangerous these labor codes are going to be. For example, when we were running this campaign since last 21st November itself, we saw that there is a sizable chunk of workers who don't understand the dangers that these labor codes pose. And then there is another segment that knows the dangers, the risk, the hazardous nature of the labor codes, but they are at sea, because even they are saying that we approach our union leaders, we say that we must go into some kind of militant action, but that sort of call is lacking. And then with this campaign, we actually appealed to all the central trade unions that you should take lead. Don't limit the action to one day ritualistic ceremonial strike call. Turn this one day call, transform, convert this one day call into a call for indefinite general strike. And that is the kind of weapon that working class must employ at this moment, because obviously to overcome this sort of attack by the fascist government, we need to resort to the measures that are of extreme nature. And with this campaign, we got to know that obviously there is a large scale discontent, but even, these workers who are organized under the banner of these central trade unions, they don't know what to do. And it's true that spontaneously, there have been many strike actions, not heeding to the call of any central trade union, but spontaneously, especially the gig workers in India. And we must salute their militancy. They are in the incipient, in an embryonic stage of forming their unions.
There was a lot in that. Mm. I guess my question is, how do we get the masses of workers to take up the call that you just said? The idea of an indefinite strike is not easy to coordinate, yet you're of the view that that is probably what it will take to overcome these labour laws.
Yes, obviously it's easier said than done. And we know that, you know, there are a lot of challenges in organizing that sort of concerted, coordinated action. But the fact still remains that the initiation has to be done at the behest of those central trade unions that are active in most of the organized sectors. And even if a call of a strike action for at least 1 week or 15 days, earlier, they were saying we'll organize a strike for 3 days. But then that sort of call did not come up. What we witnessed was a one-day call. So I know that there are going to be challenges. But what are we waiting for? Obviously, we used to say, and most of the central trade unions used to say, that it's a big weapon of the working class and it needs to be used as at an opportune time. But what could be better opportune time than the time that we are facing right now? We are in dire straits right now. And we must also put into perspective that obviously there were farmers' unions that actually did something of that sort. I don't agree with the demands that these farmers' unions were raising. For example, the demand for minimum support price. I don't agree with it. But the kind of action that they initiated was sort of an indefinite strike. They were at the borders of Delhi and they did not go back. That sort of action was there when the farmers' unions actually opposed the three farm laws launched by the Modi government. But why that sort of action is lacking here when we know that this sort of assault is unprecedented, and nowhere in the history of independent India we have witnessed that kind of assault on the rights of the working class.
Shivani, I mean, you've made a very good case for why there needs to be movement and action. I guess without any of the forces that you described, what do you think is the future of these labour laws and the situation for workers in India under them?
Situation is pretty bad because, as we discussed, now right to strike, right to collectively bargain, they have been made too difficult. Secondly, in the name of increasing working hours, because now these labor codes, for example, one of the labor codes categorically mentions that workers can be made to work overtime without mandatory payment of the overtime. So it's kind of forced labor that workers are being forced to do now. Also, with the fixed term employment, there is this provision under the new labor codes where contract system has been given a legal status. And it was there informally. This had been happening, especially in the automobile sector in India, where fixed term employment was there. But now it has been given a legal facade as well. So, for example, FTE, the fixed term employment, again, the national floor level wages, which does away with the mandatory provision of ensuring that payment of minimum wages is done. And it was a criminal liability earlier. If I'm not saying that everywhere it was implemented and, you know, capitalists were put behind bars, that was not happening earlier also. But at least there was a provision where if you don't pay minimum wages, you attracted criminal liability. Now that has been done away with. So I believe that with these labor codes in place, things are going to be difficult. Obviously, organizing strikes are going to be difficult. Getting a trade union registered is going to be difficult. And contrary to, you know, registering a trade union, registering a factory has become extremely easy. So now online, a factory owner can make an application. And the labor inspector, which is not just an inspector now, which has become an inspector cum facilitator, it can just, without any inspection, without going on ground and checking whether all kinds of provisions are being, you know, implemented, it can just give the registration online. But for registering a trade union, things have been made extremely difficult. So obviously, things are going to be difficult, but the other side of the coin is that after these labor codes have been implemented, we are also witnessing spontaneous strike actions, militant strike actions by workers also. Now, what needs to be done is to bring this element of organization, element of consciousness within these spontaneous working class actions. But that is also happening. We must not forget that the labor laws served dual roles. They were the regulatory framework as well. And obviously, the workers fought hard and, made governments recognize these rights, but they had a regulatory role to play. Now, if you just do away with all kind of regulation, then obviously things are going to take radical shape. They are going to take a militant shape. And that's what we've been witnessing for past two and a half months, what gig workers have been doing, what unorganized sectors workers have been doing. But having said that, the element of consciousness, the element of organization is needed. And still, we believe that a concerted effort needs to be built where these labor codes should be challenged. And for example, our organization and our fraternal trade unions, we are still going ahead with these campaigns where we are not just educating the working class, but also putting forth the idea that militant action needs to be initial asking. We are still appealing to these central trade unions that it's not still late. We can still initiate some sort of concerted, a coordinated effort where these labor laws could be challenged in a big way. So obviously, right now, it's a fact that the forces of labor are on a back foot. But still, with these spontaneous working class actions taking place, it also gives us a ray of hope that if there is a proper element of organization, proper element of consciousness, which is introduced in these spontaneous struggles, things are going to get better. But yes, the labor codes in the first place needs to be challenged, and we must make efforts to compel the government to take them back.
That was a conversation between Giselle Hanna from 3CR's Asia Pacific Currents and Shivani Kaur, New Delhi-based political and labour movement activist, on Saturday, the 21st of March. You can listen to Asia Pacific Currents on 3CR every Saturday morning from 9 till 9:30 a.m. Produced by Australia Asia Worker Links, Asia Pacific Currents brings you stories and issues from the Asia Pacific region with a labour and grassroots perspective. We're going to go straight into our next segment. So regular listeners of 3CR Tuesday Breakfast may recall that a few weeks ago we spoke to Lucinda Thorpe, privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch, about the new online codes requiring users to verify their age in order to access pornography and other websites containing adult content. During that conversation, Lucinda outlined the concerns for people's privacy and how age assurance will not necessarily keep children away from accessing R-rated content. Last week, I spoke to Mish Pony, CEO of Scarlet Alliance, about how this age verification will impact sex workers, how they advertise and exist online, and what this means for their clients. This conversation first aired yesterday on 3CR's Women on the Line.
Of Scarlet Alliance, which is the peak national body for sex workers and sex worker organisations across Australia.
So here on 3CR, we've been speaking about age verification and the measures being used to require people to confirm their age in order to access pornography and other gaming and other websites that contain adult content. And yeah, I was wondering if you could share your perspective as someone who works for Scarlet and advocating for the rights of sex workers.
One of the main issues is the underlying assumptions that these regulations are required in order to protect young people, when often these regulations are framed in terms of protecting young people from harmful content and then making a direct link between pornography and harm. And that link doesn't really exist in evidence. And also, when we're talking about young people accessing adult content, there's obviously different impacts for different age ranges. So, you know, when we're talking about 16 and 17 year olds looking to consume pornography, that's a very different matter to an 8 year old coming across pornography. In the literature, we also see that when it is, you know, pre-pubescent young people are seeing pornography, it's usually unintentional stumbling across it. And we don't need things like age verification to stop very young children from accidentally or unintentionally seeing pornography. Things like the simple pop-ups that come up to warn people that it's adult content and you need to be over a certain age, that is sufficient to prevent extremely young people who aren't looking for the content to seeing it. And then when we talk about older young people intentionally seeking adult content, porn, this age verification actually isn't going to stop them because they're tech savvy, they know how to get around it. And that's borne out with the, you know, extreme uptick in VPN downloads. But from a sex worker perspective, you know, this linking between porn and harm is actually just an extension of sex work stigma and discrimination. It is saying that sex worker content is harmful to society. And these aren't new arguments. This is just a rebranding of the same anti-sex work rhetoric that has been around for decades, but putting a new spin on it to make it seem more socially acceptable. Also, you know, when we're talking about these regulations, they're quite broad reaching. There's not a lot actually of a clear guidance to big tech, but there's also no protections in order to prevent big tech from blocking content that shouldn't be blocked. And so we've had concerns that sex worker advertising directories would go behind age verification, which would mean that clients or potential clients are disincentivized from accessing them, or, you know, have legitimate privacy concerns and so wouldn't go through that age assurance gate to see the ads. And that would lead to a real decrease in earnings, more precarity of work. And we've seen when other regulations that restrict clients' access to our advertising are implemented in other countries, that actually leads to sex workers having to work in less safe ways and an actual increase in violence. And as I mentioned, you know, less income, greater insecurity. So there's a whole range of other impacts when we're talking about this.
Thank you so much for that, Mission. You've mentioned so many important things that I'd like to get into if we have time.
Thank you. I did go a bit wide.
But I guess one of the things that you said, which was really interesting to me, is by putting these age assurances on this content, there's a moral judgment being made in the name or under the guise of safety, which is really interesting.
And like, you know, the eSafety Commissioner herself, who is responsible for registering and monitoring the implementation of these codes, has actually in multiple forums called porn awful but lawful. And so the person responsible has this moral judgment on porn itself. And I think, you know, that is a huge conflict of interest.
Something else that you mentioned was, something that I would like to ask you about is, how do you see this in the broader context of the discussion around the decriminalization of sex work? Because we're seeing in many states that some, not all, forms of sex work have been decriminalized. And so with these new age verification measures, how would you see the relationship between that and the broader discussions around decriminalization of this work?
Yeah, it is a bit tricky because, you know, we get these great wins in some areas and we seem to be progressing on some issues, but then at the same time on other issues we're going backwards. And so it does feel like we can't get some wins without some losses. And so I think that, you know, as you mentioned, we have decriminalization frameworks in the Northern Territory, Queensland, New South Wales, and Victoria, and the ACT has submissions open. They're closing today, which is the 1st of April for your listeners, on decriminalisation in the ACT. And so Australia is turning towards models that improve the lives of sex workers in some respects, but then in other respects, sex workers are still facing the same old stigma and discrimination and shuttering of online spaces. And it's well recognized that, you know, to work and exist in this world, online spaces are crucial.
Something that I've spoken to Lucinda from Digital Rights Watch before is about online privacy, how that's becoming increasingly difficult for us to maintain. we've discussed it within the context of the social media ban for under 16-year-olds in this country, and now with accessing pornography and other content. You mentioned this before, talking about the privacy and safety concerns of workers. So I was wondering if you could expand on that a bit more, given what we know about the discrimination and the violence that sex workers face already.
Yeah, so these new age assurance regulations won't necessarily change things for sex workers that much. For online content creators such as those who use OnlyFans, they're already required to upload extensive amount of identity documents. But that does have huge concerns for sex workers because the stigma and discrimination, and in some places criminalization, means that the linking of sex work to your legal identity can have really negative impacts. And for example, you know, in the United States, you can't travel to the USA theoretically, if you've done sex work in the past 10 years. That is the government's policy. So in this age of data linkage and surveillance, it is, you know, an increasing concern that sex workers will be outed. And, you know, in an ideal world, there would be no stigma and discrimination or criminalization. So that wouldn't be an issue. But that's not the world we live in. And so sex workers do take active steps every day to avoid that stigma and discrimination. But for consumers of pornography and clients, again, having to provide either a facial scan or the upload of an identity document in order to access that content is justifiably a huge privacy risk. There's already been well-documented massive data breaches that included hackers stealing identity documentation and facial scans of things like dating websites. And people try and minimize the potential negative consequences of this by saying that the companies undergoing the age assurance just take a quick photo and then they delete it straight away. The reality is, and this is from the government's own age assurance trial that they conducted, was that companies are holding on to this data. So it is not just a one and done and it's gone forever. That's not the reality. And, you know, we wish it was, but it's not. And, you know, we've seen time and time again, massive data breaches. And just imagine if a hacker got access to the photos of people logging into Pornhub or their ID documents. That could be, again, very disastrous for people. Porn is still a bit of a taboo, stigmatizing topic. So, you know, it is something that people have real fears and concerns about.
Thank you, Mish. You were talking before about the impact that this could have on advertising for sex workers online. So, yeah, just a bit more about this would be great if you can expand a bit more.
Yeah. So the online codes, which require age assurance, talk about adult content being, you know, pornography, but also things like high impact nudity and also explicit discussions around sex. And so in a sex worker's advertising, there may be explicit nudity or there may be explicit descriptions of sex acts that the sex worker provides. Things are still rolling out, so there's no definitive answers yet, which is also, you know, a source of anxiety to many of us. We have been in communication with an advertising directory that is implementing age assurance, but not for the whole website. They're just going to hide the more explicit parts of someone's advertising. But, you know, if you're a sex worker and you're talking about the sex acts that you provide, you want clients to see that so they know what you offer. And, you know, I'm very doubtful that clients are going to want to feel comfortable enough to undergo age assurance to see an unfiltered ad. But the other impacts of this are, you know, these regulations just tell tech platforms or hosting services that adult content as a whole is just too risky, that there's too much regulation, it's just a hassle to understand what is and isn't allowed, there's huge fines if you get it wrong. And so what's easier for tech platforms is just to say, no, we're not going to host adult content, we're not going to host sex work content. And again, we've seen this before when the United States implemented FOSTA SESTA back in around 2018. Websites that sex workers were using for safety and for community were shut down because tech providers just couldn't be bothered to really understand that actually this content isn't illegal under the new legislation. It just creates a chilling effect. It's also something we've seen for decades in social media, that sex workers' accounts get deleted randomly or shadow banned, and there's no opportunity for redress. And so if we're saying to social media platforms, you need to make sure that adult content goes behind age assurance or we're going to fine you, they're probably, you know, many of them will think it's just easier to not bother and just to not allow sex workers to exist online.
Thanks so much for that, Mish. Finally, before you go, if there are workers who are listening to this conversation, they're worried about how this will impact their work, or if there are just people in general who are really interested in learning more about how this age assurance will impact sex workers, do you have any resources that people can access to find out more?
Yeah, so on the Scarlet Alliance website, we have a briefing paper about the impacts of online regulation that really goes into detail about these unintended consequences and impacts. And for sex workers who are looking for support in navigating digital spaces, maybe they're having issues with an advertiser or, you know, not sure about what the future holds, each state and territory has a sex worker organization that has sex worker peers that they can have a chat to and work out what's happening. But, you know, our website will constantly be updated. Hopefully in the near future, we'll have a section dedicated to, you know, this online regulation.
You're listening to 3CR, and that was Mish Pony, CEO of Scarlet Alliance, speaking to me about the implementation of strict age verification and the impacts this will have on sex workers online. You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast, and we're going to play a song for you now.
Yeah, so this is from Owelu Dreamhouse, a collaboration from vocalist Nkechi Enole and arranger and multi-instrumentalist Nick Ryan Glennie, and they have just had their album launch this last Saturday at the Night Cat. The eponymous album has already been described as a masterpiece of cinematic soul, psychedelia, and Afrobeat. This is Realized. Thank you.
That was Oilu Dreamhouse with their song Realized from their latest album. Up next, we are going to be listening from Tamil refugee and member of Refugee Women's Action for Visa Equality, Rathi Bathlod, speaking at the Unite to Fight Racism forum organized by Refugee Action Collective, which was held on 24 February earlier this year. Rathi shares about the struggles she faced in fighting for visa equality for refugees, as well as the wins they have achieved through their concerted campaign. She notes in particular how systemic racism manifests in policies such as offshore processing and continues to dehumanize and demonize those who are from so-called lesser countries.
Hello everyone, nice to see you. Friends and comrades, I want to acknowledge the land we meet on today. I pay my respect elders past, present and emerging. This land always was, always will be Aboriginal land. I stand before you today not just a speaker. I stand here as a Tamil woman, as someone who has lived through displacement, racism and the constant experience of being told I do not belong. My people were bombed, displaced, silenced. I survived war and genocide. I came to Australia seeking safety, but safety alone is not freedom. Because racism does not always come with a gun. Sometimes it comes as legislation. Sometimes it comes as borders. Sometimes it comes quietly. It defines you by the color of your skin and tells you whether you belong. And racism tells refugees, you are not from here. You must wait. You must suffer quietly. For more than 13 years, thousands of refugees in this country were forced to live in uncertainty, without permanent status, without security, without dignity. That was not an accident. That was not a mistake. It was a system designed to make human beings feel temporary. A system designed to make us feel like we do not belong. A system that denies human dignity. But I stand here to say, we are not temporary. We are human beings. We are workers. We are mothers. We are survivors. And we are leaders. And today, I am proud to stand here as a refugee who helped lead a campaign that secured permanent visas for nearly 10,000 refugees. For more than 3 years, the Labor government promised compassion. They said they would resolve our situation. They spoke about fairness and dignity. But nothing changed. We were told to be patient. We were told to wait. We were told to be grateful. But we refused to accept permanent uncertainty. It took 22 gorgeous women, Tamil and Iranian women, walking all the way to Canberra to force action. Their bravery sparked a wave of protest across the country. Refugees organized. We rallied. We protested in places like Dockland, even when we were told to stay quiet, even when we were told to accept suffering. But silence protects injustice. And when we raised our voices, change followed. The movement grew so strong that the Minister for Home Affairs was forced to introduce the changes we had been demanding. Today, every single person in my refugee community has received their permanent visas. This victory belongs first and foremost to the refugees who led the fight. It belongs to the women who walked. It belongs to every refugee who refused to give up. But it also belonged to those who stood in solidarity with us, especially the union movement led by the United Workers Union the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, the Refugee Action Collective, Grandmother for Refugees, Rural Australians for Refugees, and other refugees organisations, and every single person who stood shoulder to shoulder with refugees. Thank you. This was not a gift from government. This was not charity. This was solidarity, and solidarity wins. But while we celebrate this victory, we must also speak honestly. The fight is not over. Government in this country have a long history of offering half solution. They act only when pressured. They resolve part of the problem, but never all of it. Around 800 refugees who have lived here for over 13 years have been denied permanent visas on so-called character grounds. Some because of minor driving offenses. Some because of small mistake linked to trauma and mental health struggles. After surviving war and displacement, they were still being told they are not worthy of belonging. Refugees on Manus and Nauru are still living in limbo. Temporary protection visas and chef visas continue to be granted to those who arrived after 2023, keeping people in permanent insecurity. Many of our Palestinian brothers and sisters who fled genocide will only receive temporary visa if they seek asylum, not permanent protection. And the government has committed to keeping Manus and Nauru open years to come. We are often told to fear hardline racist coming to power. But what do we call a system that keeps refugees temporary, disposable, and uncertain for over a decade? Racism not only about hateful words shouted in the street. Racism is structural. It is policy. It is detention. It is offshore processing. It is temporary protection. It is a system designed to divide us and make us fear an other. Racism against First Nation people in Australia has led to inequality in healthcare, education, and employment opportunities. Racism divides refugees from workers, migrants from citizens, Muslims from other communities. Racism survives on division. And while we are divided, the powerful benefit. Politicians are happy to blame refugees for housing shortage, for economic processes, for problem we did not create, the problem we are not created, instead of addressing inequality and justice. Let us be clear. Refugees did not create poverty. Refugees did not create war. Refugees did not create economic crisis. Refugees are survivors of those injustices. And that is why the lesson of our permanent visa campaign is so important. Changes does not come from polite request. Change comes from organized people. When refugees protest in Dockland, we were told to be quiet. We were told to say thank you. We were told to accept what we were given. But we refused. Because we know something powerful when people unite. Government are forced to listen. To defeat racism in this country, we must build a movement that cannot be ignored, just like we did in the permanent visas campaign. When workers stand with refugees, we are powerful. When communities stand with Muslims, we are powerful. When women rise as leaders, we are powerful. When we unite, racism cannot win. Our struggles are connected. Around the world, Palestinians are resisting dispossession and violence just as Tamil racist genocide. Our fight is part of a global struggle for dignity, the right to live safely with rights and respect. I stand here today because others fought before me, and now it is our responsibility to continue that struggle, not only for ourselves, but for next generation, so that no child grow up feeling unwanted. So know that refugees live in fear. So that no human being is treated as disposable. It is not enough to believe in change. We must organize to change. We must speak. We must fight. History teaches us one simple truth. Every right we have today exists because someone struggled for it. So we will continue to struggle until every refugee has permanent safety, until every migrant lives with dignity, until offshore detention ends, until racism is defeated, until Palestinians are free. We are not alone. We are not weak. We are united. And when we are united, we win. Thank you so much.
We've been listening to Tamil refugee and co-founder of Refugee Women Action for Visa Equality, Rathi Bathlode, sharing at the United to Fight Racism Forum held by Refugee Action Collective last February.
Today in the studio, we have Camille Perry. Camille is a queer artist and photographer whose work explores unique film processes and ecological ethics. Camille's research practice considers the contradictions within the world of photography. So thank you so much for coming into the show today.
It's my pleasure. Yes. Nice to be here.
Yeah, it's so good to see you again.
Yeah, I know, good to see you too.
Yes. I guess the last time we met was actually overseas, which is pretty crazy. And in Madrid, in Spain. And I know that you were doing an artist residency there for Joya.
Yeah.
I was looking back at that work that you did with Joya. And I was always so excited by the fact that you were using this like plant-based film, which was something I'd never heard at the time. So I'd love for you to tell me more about that and more about,
Sure. So I guess a lot of the work that I was doing at Joya was about, because it's quite an arid, it's in like quite an arid part of Spain. And so there's, and because of just the growing change in climate, less and less things can actually grow there. And then they have a residency space there for artists to come and work. And they have like a garden there, which they're just like testing how to grow certain things in that environment. And so working with the organizers there, it was just, it's kind of like, I don't know how to describe it in a sense without like, it's kind of like cooking. Yeah. I always just talk about it like cooking because I feel like chemistry feels very like unattainable and also very like ontological in a way, which is like very like colonial Western focus. Whereas I feel like it is more of like when I think about film developing and how the processes I use, it's very much like go into my garden and grab a little bit of sage and chop it up and then like see, get it to like put it in water, get it to boil, get it to a particular color. And then you add a little bit of like vitamin C, whether that's from like oranges or like Kakadu plums or like from like vitamin C tablets or whatever, you know, whatever you have available. It's kind of like very much just like fumbling around, but like kind of following the trail of things that you have available to you. And so it was kind of working with a lot, especially in that part of Spain, there was like heaps of rosemary. So I was working with rosemary a lot.
Wow.
Which was really nice because the smell is so beautiful.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's really awesome. Actually, I remember you saying that you were using rosemary specifically.
Yeah.
And it's really important. Like, with cooking or photography or like creative things, it's cool to use what you already have and like it's 100% sustainable.
It also makes for better art. I don't know. I feel like all my favorite artists are people who kind of were like, okay, what can I do with what I have?
Yeah.
It's almost like the parameters of like your access to things makes you think outside of the box. It makes you kind of push your ideas a bit more. It kind of makes it challenges you, which I think is really important in art, is to be challenged.
100%. Like, yeah, having to use what's just in front of you is in itself, yeah, sort of like a positive boundary, because yeah. It's like, yeah, you're using from your environment.
Yeah.
Which is why I think, yeah, the work was definitely reflective of that space that you were in, which is like awesome. So do you find that all the different work that you do sort of reflects where you are, whether like in your landscape or where you are in life? Or,
definitely. Yeah. Oh my God, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, I feel like a lot of my work is kind of dependent on like the physicality of where I am, of like what I'm, also seasonality of things as well, what's available, like what is growing in my garden. I just grew the most incredible, corn. It's like did you see the corn?
Saw the corn. It's purple.
It's purple. That's cool. The most beautiful. And I'm like trying to figure out how to develop film with it. And so that's going to be like my next activity.
Oh my God, that's so cool.
Because it was just the most beautiful harvest ever. And I'm like, feeling very happy about that.
Wow.
But I don't want to eat it. I was like, it's so beautiful. How can you? I don't know if I want to,
Oh my gosh. Well.
Or turn into, film developer. But it'll be interesting. We'll see.
And so how do you know though? Like, how do you know, like, if you use these things to develop film, how do you know how it's going to turn out? Like, do you know?
You don't.
And like,
you don't. That's the fun.
Yeah.
That's the fun. It's also like you kind of become really comfortable with mistakes as well. Yeah. And also just like risk and also just like listening to things.
Yeah.
I always like think about it like, a lot of it is like, if you look at the like science of it, of like, it's like anything that's high in polyphenols, which is kind of, polyphenols are really common in like, what do you call it? I'm trying to think of the word. It's like, anything that is, why has it just gone to me? But it's like wine, chocolate, antioxidants.
Oh, cool. Antioxidants.
So anything that's really high in antioxidants usually is really high in polyphenol.
Okay.
Or like usually also is really fragrant as well. So like you're kind of just like smelling everything and like kind of just like, I don't know. Uh-huh. It's this funny thing of you're just kind of like feeling everything out a little bit.
Yeah.
And also just like you make mistakes and then you find the beauty in the mistakes. Like with the film that I worked on, which we developed in like alternative, whole things developed in alternative chemistry.
Yes.
It like you get these kind of like scratchy, little overexposed, it almost looks like you're like diving into a universe and there are all these little scratches that just kind of appear on the surface. Yeah. And it's like, I love that stuff.
Me too.
I like it when it doesn't look like something and you got to find something in it. I feel like that's awesome.
I think so too. I think it makes it like unique and like I think everything these days is super digital and airbrushed. So it's cool to have something that's like got a character and like it has come from something.
Totally. It was amazing seeing one of the films that like that I had developed, Mistake Me for Anybody, and it was played at Acme and they used actual 16mm projectors because it is impossible to find anywhere that will play a film on an old projector. Like it's so nice to make a film and not see it until it's on the big screen kind of thing, until it's like screened through that actual film, and the detail is amazing. Like it's like digital data is like all, it's all in these little pixels. It's very discreet. There's only so much you can get out of something. And, like, film, it's just, like, expansive.
Yeah.
It's, like, just cool. You can just make it. You can blow it up huge and it doesn't lose any of that, I don't know, detail.
Yeah. I think it's we're so lucky that we're able to experiment with different types of film.
Right.
And, like, have that option.
Yeah.
I saw some of the work that you did with Mistake Me for Anything, which I think that's such an awesome title and it was beautiful. And I guess, my question was how did you first get into film? Like, this might be a big question, but I mean, I feel like it's definitely your thing. And how did you first get that sort of draw?
I think that I started to get into it. I mean, I feel like it's the point of access that I feel like a lot of people get into film developing or like film at all is like when I went on school camp and I got a little disposable camera, which I feel like is like classic, and it's just like photos of like my 12-year-old friends and then like the grass and then like you know, just like random photos. And I was like, oh, this is just so cool. Like, I just found it like magic. I was like, I love this. I want to keep doing this. And then I was really lucky like at my high school, because the darkroom building was made of asbestos, they couldn't destroy it, so like we had a darkroom that no one used, and so we just got to hang out in there, which was pretty fun. And I feel like it just that's kind of how it started, and then I just became really infatuated with it. I was like, I love photography.
Love it. Awesome, because it is really fun as well. And I was reading some of what you wrote on your website about your work, and also I suppose the I know you discussed the ecological cost of image making and more of the ethics side of photography, which I also think is really interesting. So I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jump to that.
So yeah, no, definitely. I feel like photography is a very ethically problematic medium. I mean, like, from its origin of like how it was used in like colonial expansion, that's like a huge role of how like the companies like Kodak, Ilford, like all of these companies came into being and had a lot of money. That's where they got a lot of money from. And in order to also facilitate the key, like, not only just the propaganda of what the photos were supposed to represent, but then actually the construction of them, like, all of these materials are mined, you know, like we kind of dissociate and ourselves from the materiality of every day. Like, there's this kind of sense of like cognitive dissonance that happens all the time, you know, from like your laptop to like your phone and everything that we use every day. Like, we are completely severed from where it comes from. And that's like that is a tool, you know, like that's been like used against us in a lot of ways, individuals, like to be able to understand like the links to everything that we're using. It gives us more power in making choices, you know. When you're denied that information, it's hard to make the right choices, you know. And so a lot of like, I kind of started deep diving into all this research about photography, specifically around like the Kodak factory in along the Mary Creek in Coburg. And that's kind of where a lot of that thinking came from, of like, I'm using this material, I love photography, but I also understand like the implications of it, of like, it's quite a violent medium in all of its, in all the sense of the word, you know, in how it's been kind of used in history, in how it's created physically, and then how it's mass produced now, you know, and like where all these materials come from. And I think it's a complicated question of like what to do when it comes to photography, because it's also an incredibly powerful tool in telling stories. The fact that it's become more of a accessible way for anyone to tell stories, like so many people have access to cameras, people can tell their own stories. It's amazing. That's so powerful and important. But at the same time, there is this very real dependency that companies like Kodak have created for people. Like, they've made us, it's an extension of our reality. We can't imagine life without photography. And they, if you look back at all of their advertising material, it's that was their intention. They make you scared of losing the present. Wow. And so they build in this idea of fear of like, oh, you need photography. Without photography, you cease to exist, you know?
Yeah.
You have to prove that you've existed, that these things have happened. You know?
Oh, 100%. And I think that's definitely, like, how photography sort of become, like, with social media and how we have to log everything.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting topic. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Happy to.
Yeah, thank you. I would love to keep chatting, but
we can in the future.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
More chatting to come.
Yes, thank you. So thank you for coming onto the show today, Camille. And any listeners who are interested, you can watch a screening of their upcoming experimental film, Silver Curtain, at the Brunswick Underground Film Festival that will be running in around mid-May. You've been listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
And to finish up today's show, we'll be speaking to Noor and Gabby from Unassigned Gallery, which is a grassroots multi-purpose creative space located in Brunswick. Noor is the founder of Unassigned Gallery and Gabby runs weekly life drawing sessions in the space. And today they join us to discuss the gallery's upcoming exhibitions and programming with a focus on the life drawing series. Thanks for joining us on 3CR, Noor and Gabby.
Thank you for having us. Thank you so much.
Let's start with just a brief introduction. Was wondering if you could each introduce yourselves to our listeners. And Noor, we'll start with you.
I'm Noor. I'm the founder and director of Unassigned Gallery, which I opened about 3.5 years ago. It's a small community gallery with a focus on giving back more than it takes. Mm.
And Gabby?
I'm Gabby. I have been a part of the Unassigned community for a few years now as well. And I work with Noor, I'm part of the board here, and I also run the life drawing program with Noor, which is weekly, yes, but we've also got exciting new things coming up as well.
Yeah, can't wait to hear more about that. I just wanted to quickly reiterate what you were saying, Noor, about it being a community space that gives more than it takes. I think I really like that idea, especially in a world where we've got these capitalist and colonial systems and institutions that are constantly trying to extract from people's creativity. So I love that sentiment. Gabby, I was wondering if you could tell us more about these life drawing sessions that you've been running and, yeah, the exciting developments that are happening there.
Yeah, thank you. So our life drawing, we have been running weekly for about a year and a bit now. It's actually been a program that's occurred here at Unassigned Gallery for the whole duration of its opening. But for the past year, we've made it really regular, which has been awesome. We've had great community feedback. So we've just been honestly overwhelmed. And therefore, to give more in that sense, we've added new timetabling to the program as well. So we've added fortnightly Tuesday classes, and other special themed classes such as life drawing, dog life drawing, sorry, which was a recent hit with an amazing artist called Tallulah. So we're trying to offer a more diverse range of classes for people. And, so this is perfect timing to be talking about it because today is actually our first Tuesday life drawing. We're trying to, add more opportunities and programming for our community, which... Yeah, we're very grateful for their support because they have just shown up time and time again.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. And I think I remember seeing some whippets being modelled in your life drawing sessions. And as a proud owner of two whippets, I was very excited to see them being represented in an art class. Just on the sort of theme of community, I was wondering, you know, for people who out there who are perhaps a bit hesitant to join a life drawing class for whatever reason, I think, you know, people do have can feel a bit nervous about sharing their creativity in a room with other people. Noor, what would you say to encourage newcomers to join, especially in a space that is as open and as welcoming as Unassigned Gallery?
I know it can be really daunting, like the idea of, oh my God, I'm in a room with like 20 people and they're probably all amazing artists and I might like draw something bad or whatever, it might be embarrassing. But we are so casual here. I think that everyone who has come has had such a great time, and I think it is also because of the community that Gabby was talking about. Everyone's so welcoming and inclusive, and no one would ever make anyone feel bad about whatever skill level they have. Like, we have, like, people who are, established artists who come and they're
engaging with beginner artists and like sharing tips and sharing materials. And we just keep it really fun and chill. We also like encourage, you know, we start off with our quick drawings, like 30 seconds, 1 minute. There's no way you're going to do a finished drawing in that time. So we're kind of encouraging, get the jitters out, get the bad drawings out. Like there's space for that. And we give you permission to do that. And yeah, I mean, I learned from Gabby and Rosie, who was one of our previous facilitators, and Bonnie as well. So I feel like I learnt by coming and doing it, and it's been, yeah, the best experience ever. So I feel like if you're here and you can see the incredible community, you'd automatically just feel like at ease.
Yeah, I love that. Thanks so much for that, Noor. And Gabby, as someone who, yeah, is, you know, a facilitator of these life drawing sessions, can you talk a bit about the beauty of life drawing, being in the moment, doing like quick sketches, like Noor was saying, it doesn't have to be a finished product. I think in a world where things are very like polished and shiny and AI generated, things that you know, Camille was just speaking to Julie about before in their previous interview. What draws you to life drawing?
Yeah, life drawing is a very immediate form of kind of like engaging with, yeah, what's presently in front of you, and also with like humanity, because, I'll speak to the human life drawing. the dog life drawing is immediate too, but I don't run those. But with drawing a human figure, it's very immediate. It's very, it's a very special kind of experience that can't necessarily be replicated in the outside world. So what we try and curate is a very safe environment in which people can appreciate and learn about the human form in a way that isn't necessarily encouraged by mass culture and stuff like that. Like, we do have very interesting conversations about life drawing with people who do come, but also people who are thinking about coming or unsure if they want to come. It's a really interesting space, because having a nude figure to draw as a reference, if you're an artist already, that could be a more familiar idea. But if you're not an artist at all, sometimes this can be a really foreign idea. And even within an artist community, people's thresholds can be really different. Mm-hmm. So there is a kind of call to presentness that comes with the form of life drawing that I think is quite unique and special to, yeah, a drawing environment of that kind. On that note as well, we believe really strongly in our ethos of representing very diverse bodies in terms of gender expression, like physical size, age diversity, ethnicity, stuff like that, because we also find that that is not always prioritized in life drawing culture in general. Sometimes these things can become a little bit caught up in, mass cultural forces such as like beauty standards. Mm-hmm. We never want it to become like a fetishized or, yeah, a space that relies on kind of like external indicators of beauty and things like that. It's more about treating the body as a neutral and interesting thing to be representing in our art.
Mm, I love that. Thank you so much for that, Gabby. And finally, Noor, for people who are interested in signing up, or if they want to find out more about what's coming up at Unassigned, where should they go for more information?
Yeah, so if you're on social media, you can jump on our Instagram, which is unassigned_gallery, and we post everything there first. But if you're not on social media, we also have a website, which is www.unassignedgallery.com. I can't remember if there's a .au at the end, but I'm sure people can figure that out. We have one of our volunteers, Bridge, is also a graphic designer and has been designing a monthly What's On calendar for us. And so that is the first thing you'll see pinned on Instagram. And today I'm going to pop it on the website as well for anyone who's not on social media. So you can just have like a really quick at a glance look of what we have each month. And at the end of each month, we post the next one for the following month so that people just know what's happening.
Yep. I love that. Well, thank you both so much for joining us on the show, and to yeah, speak about the power of life drawing, and how I really like what you're both saying about the humanity of the practice, but also, yeah, forcing everyone to be present in the moment, especially in a world that's like really busy and there's so many things going on. So thank you both so much for coming on the show this morning.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
So we've been speaking to Noor and Gabby from Unassigned Gallery about this community space and art gallery, but also their life drawing sessions that are being run weekly. And just as Noor said, they've got a calendar on their Instagram of upcoming events. Today being the 7th of April, there's a life drawing session from 7 to 8 p.m. We will be back with a rundown of today's show in just a moment.
ECR, your station, your voice.
Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan.
Welcome to Rainbows Don't Fade with Age on Radio 3CR.
Welcome to Trans Creator Radio.
Where history's queer futures is an audio journey into the
Trans Day of Audibility, a day for us to be heard and not seen.
3CR, your station, your voice.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast. We've come towards the end of our show. And just before we give you a rundown on what we had on today's program, just wanted to give everyone a heads up that next Friday, the 17th of April, from 1 p.m. to 2 p.m., the Australian Unemployed Workers Union have organized an event called Justice for Josh 10 Years On, commemorating the death of 18-year-old Josh Park Fing, who died at his forced labour work for the Dole site in Toowoomba 10 years ago. Despite a court finding that Josh's work for the Dole site did not meet basic safety standards, neither the government nor his for-profit privately owned employment service provider were held accountable. So there will be a rally outside the office of Andrew Giles, the Labor Minister responsible for work for the Dole, organised again for next Friday, the 17th of April from 1 to 2 p.m. And I'm sure there will be more information regarding this event in the next couple of weeks. So to talk about what we had on today's show, we started by replaying a segment of Asia Pacific Currents where Giselle Hannah spoke to Shivani Kaur, a New Delhi-based political and labour movement activist, speaking about the new labour codes introduced in India in November last year. Then we heard from Mish Pony, CEO of Scarlet Alliance, who spoke about the impact of age assurance on sex workers online.
At 7:45, we listened to Tamil refugee and co-founder of Refugee Women Action for Visa Equality, Rathi Bathlud, sharing at the United to Fight Racism Forum held by Refugee Action Collective last February.
At 8 a.m., we spoke with Camille Perry, who is a queer artist and photographer, who spoke to us further about their film processes and the ethics of photography.
And finally, at 8:15, we spoke to Noor and Gabby from Unassigned Gallery. They both spoke about the weekly life drawing lessons in their space, as well as, yeah, the broader sort of discussions around the practice of life drawing. So that is all that we have on today's show. Make sure to check out the podcast at 3cr.org.au/Tuesday-breakfast. But otherwise, stay tuned because up next is Accent of Women. We'll be back next week at 7 a.m. for another edition of Tuesday Breakfast. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.